Chapter 36. Apparently it was a great hit. It fetched thunders of joyous enthusiasm out of the Christian socialists, and in their rapture they flung biting epithets with wasteful liberality at specially detested members of the opposition. Among others, this one at Schoenherr, Bortel and der Krugerstrasse. Then they added these words, which they whooped, howled, and also even sang, in a deep-voiced chorus. Schmoliebkon. 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 And made it splendidly audible above the banging of desk boards, and the rest of the roaring cyclone of fiendish noises. A gallery witticism comes flitting by from mouth to mouth around the great curve. The swan song of Austrian representative government. You can note its progress by the applausive smiles and nods it gets as it skims along. Klitzember. Holofernes, where is Judith? Storm of laughter. Gregorig, the shirt merchant, this wolf theater is costing 6,000 florins. Wolf with sweetness, notice him. Gentlemen, it is Mr. Gregorig. Laughter. Vialaic to Wolf, you Judas. Schneider. Brothel night. Chorus of voices. East German awful tub. And so the war of epithets crashes along, with never diminishing energy, for a couple of hours. The ladies in the gallery were learning. That was well. For by and by ladies will form a part of the membership of all the legislatures in the world. As soon as they can prove competency they will be admitted. At present, men only are competent to legislate. Therefore they look down upon women, and would feel degraded if they had to have them for colleagues in their high calling. Wolf is yelling another market report now. Jessman. Shut up, infamous louse brat. During a momentary lull Dr. Luiger gets a hearing for three sentences of his speech. The demand and require that the president shall suppress the four noisiest members of the opposition. Wolf, with a that settles it toss of the head, the shifty trickster of Vienna has spoken. Iro belonged to Schoenherr's party. The word of honor incident has given it a new name. Gregorig is a Christian socialist, and hero of the post-dash cards, and the Wimberger soda squirting incident. He stands vast and conspicuous, and conceited and self-satisfied, and roosterish and inconsequential, at Luiger's elbow, and is proud, and cocky to be in such a great company. He looks very well indeed, really majestic, and aware of it. He crows out his little empty remark, now and then, and looks as pleased as if he had been delivered of the Ausgleich. Indeed, he does look notably fine. He wears almost the only dress vest on the floor. It exposes a continental spread of white shirt front. His hands are posed at ease in the lips of his trousers pockets. His head is tilted back complacently. He is attitudinizing. He is playing to the gallery. However, they are all doing that. It is curious to see. Men who only vote, and can't make speeches, and don't know how to invent witty ejaculations, wander about the vacated parts of the floor, and stop in a good place and strike attitudes suggestive of weighty thought, mostly, and glance furtively up at the galleries, to see how it works. Or a couple will come together, and shake hands in an artificial way, and laugh a gay manufactured laugh, and do some constrained, and self-conscious attitudinizing, and they steal glances at the galleries to see if they are getting notice. It is like a scene on the stage by play by minor actors at the back, while the stars do the great work at the front. Even Count Badenai attitudinizes for a moment. Strikes a reflective Napoleonic attitude of fine picturesqueness, but soon thinks better of it and desists. There are two who do not attitudinize, poor harried and insulted President Abrahamowicz, who seems wholly miserable, and can find no way to put in the dreary time, but by swinging his bell and discharging occasional remarks which nobody can hear, and a resigned and patient priest, who sits lonely in a great vacancy on majority territory and munches an apple. Schoenherer uplifts his foghorn of a voice, and shakes the roof with an insult discharged at the majority. Dr. Luger. The honorless party would better keep still here. Apostrophe, Gregorig, the echo, swelling out his shirt front.
Yes, keep quiet, pimp.
Apostrophe, apostrophe, Schoenherer, to Luger, political mountebank. Apostrophe, Prochaska, to Schoenherer, drunken clown. Apostrophe, during the final hour of the sitting many happy phrases were distributed through the proceedings. Among them were these, and they are strikingly good ones. Blatherskite. Apostrophe, apostrophe, blackguard. Apostrophe, apostrophe, scoundrel. Apostrophe, apostrophe, brothel daddy. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this last was the contribution of Dr. Jessman, and gave great satisfaction. And deservedly. It seems to me that it was one of the most sparkling things that was said during the whole evening. At 2:30 in the morning the House adjourned. The victory was with the opposition. No, not quite that. The effective part of it was snatched away from them by an unlawful exercise of presidential force, another contribution toward driving the mistreated minority out of their minds. At other sittings of the parliament, gentlemen of the opposition, shaking their fists toward the president, addressed him as Polish dog. At one sitting an angry deputy turned upon a colleague and shouted, apostrophe, 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 you must try to imagine what it was. If I should offer it even in the original it would probably not get by the editor's blue pencil. To offer a translation would be, to waste my ink, of course. This remark was frankly printed in its entirety by one of the Vienna dailies, but the others disguised the toughest half of it with stars. If the reader will go back over this chapter, and gather its array of extraordinary epithets into a bunch and examine them, he will marvel at two things. How this convention of gentlemen could consent to use such gross terms, and why the users were allowed to get out the place alive. There is no way to understand this strange situation. If every man in the house were a professional blackguard, and had his home in a sailor boarding house, one could still not understand it. For, although that sort do use such terms, they never take them. These men are not professional blackguards. They are mainly gentlemen, and educated. Yet they use the terms, and take them too. They really seem to attach no consequence to them. One cannot say that they act like schoolboys, for that is only almost true, not entirely. Schoolboys blackguard each other fiercely, and by the hour, and one would think that nothing would ever come of it but noise, but that would be a mistake. Up to a certain limit the result would be noise only, but, that limit overstepped, trouble would follow right away. There are certain phrases, phrases of a peculiar character, phrases of the nature of that reference to Schoenherer's grandmother, for instance, which not even the most spiritless schoolboy in the English-speaking world would allow to pass unavenged. One difference between schoolboys and the lawmakers of the Reichsrath seems to be that the lawmakers have no limit, no danger line. Apparently they may call each other what they please, and go home unmutilated. Now, in fact, they did have a scuffle on two occasions, but it was not on account of names called. There has been no scuffle where that was the cause. It is not to be inferred that the house lacks a sense of honor because it lacks delicacy. That would be an error. Iroh was caught in a lie, and it profoundly disgraced him. The house cut him. Turned its back upon him. He resigned his seat, otherwise he would have been expelled. But it was lenient with Gregorig, who had called Iroh a cowardly blatherskite in debate. It merely went through the form of mildly censuring him. That did not trouble Gregorig. The Viennese say of themselves that they are an easy-going, pleasure-loving community, making the best of life, and not taking it very seriously. Nevertheless, they are grieved about the ways of their parliament, and say quite frankly that they are ashamed. They claim that the low condition of the Parliament's manners is new, not old. A gentleman who was at the head of the government 20 years ago confirms this, and says that in his time the Parliament was orderly and well behaved. An English gentleman of long residence here endorses this, and says that a low order of politicians originated the present forms of questionable speech on the stump some years ago, and imported them into the Parliament. 2. However, someday there will be a minister of etiquette and a sergeant-at-arms, and then things will go better. I mean if Parliament and the Constitution survive the present storm. IV. The historic climax, during the whole of November things went from bad to worse. The all-important Ausgleich remained hard aground, and could not be sparred off. But Denny's government could not withdraw the language ordinance and keep its majority, and the opposition could not be placated on easier terms. One night, while the customary pandemonium was crashing, and thundering along at its best, a fight broke out. It was a surging, struggling, shoulder-to-shoulder scramble. A great many blows were struck. Twice Schonerer lifted one of the heavy ministerial faduls, some say with one hand, and threatened members of the majority with it, but it was wrenched away from him. A member hammered Wolf over the head with the president's bell, and another member choked him. A professor was flung down and belabored with fists and choked. He held up an open penknife as a defense against the blows. It was snatched from him, and flung to a distance. It hit a peaceful Christian socialist who wasn't doing anything, and brought blood from his hand. This was the only blood drawn. The men who got hammered and choked looked sound and well next day. The fists and the bell were not properly handled, or better results would have been apparent. I am quite sure that the fighters were not in earnest. On Thanksgiving Day the sitting was a history-making one. On that day the harried, bedeviled, and despairing government went insane. In order to free itself from the thraldom of the opposition it committed this curiously juvenile crime. It moved an important change of the rules of the House, forbade debate upon the motion, put it to a stand-up vote instead of ayes and noes, and then gravely claimed that it had been adopted. Whereas, to even the dullest witness, if I without immodesty, may pretend to that place, it was plain that nothing legitimately to be called a vote had been taken at all. I think that Saltpeter never uttered a truer thing than when he said, "Whom the gods would destroy they first make mad." Evidently the government's mind was tottering, when this bald insults to the House was the best way it could contrive for getting out of the frying pan. The episode would have been funny if the matter at stake had been a trifle, but in the circumstances it was pathetic. The usual storm was raging in the House. As usual, many of the majority and the most of the minority were standing up to have a better chance to exchange epithets and make other noises. Into this storm Count Falkenhayn entered, with his paper in his hand, and at once there was a rush to get near him and hear him read his motion. In a moment he was walled in by listeners. The several clauses of his motion were loudly applauded by these allies, and as loudly disapplauded, if I may invent a word, by such of the opposition as could hear his voice. When he took his seat the president promptly put the motion, "Persons desiring to vote in the affirmative, stand up." The House was already standing up, had been standing for an hour, and before a third of it had found out what the president had been saying, he had proclaimed the adoption of the motion. And only a few heard that. In fact, when that House is legislating you can tell it from artillery practice. You will realize what a happy idea it was to sidetrack the lawful ayes and noes and substitute a stand-up vote by this fact. That a little later, when a deputation of deputies waited upon the president, and asked him if he was actually willing to claim that that measure had been passed, he answered, "Yes, and unanimously." It shows that in effect the whole House was on its feet when that trick was sprung.
The Lexfell canon, apostrophe thus strangely born, gave the president power to suspend for 3 days any deputy who should continue to be disorderly after being called to order twice, and it also placed at his disposal such force as might be necessary to make the suspension effective. So the House had a sergeant-at-arms at last, and a more formidable one, as to power, than any other legislature in Christendom had ever possessed. The Lex Fel Canon also gave the House itself authority to suspend members for 30 days. On these terms the Ausgleich could be put through in an hour apparently. The opposition would have to sit meek and quiet, and stop obstructing, or be turned into the street, deputy after deputy, leaving the majority an unvexed field for its work. Certainly the thing looked well. The government was out of the frying pan at last. It congratulated itself, and was almost girlishly happy. Its stock rose suddenly from less than nothing to a premium. It confessed to itself, with pride, that its Lex Fel Canon was a master-stroke, a work of genius. However, there were doubters, men who were troubled, and believed that a grave mistake had been made. It might be that the opposition was crushed, and profitably for the country too. But the manner of it, that was the serious part. It could have far-reaching results, results whose gravity might transcend all guessing. It might be the initial step toward a return to government by force, a restoration of the irresponsible methods of obsolete times. There were no vacant seats in the galleries next day. In fact, standing room outside the building was at a premium. There were crowds there, and a glittering array of helmeted and brass-buttoned police, on foot and on horseback, to keep them from getting too much excited. No one could guess what was going to happen, but everyone felt that something was going to happen, and hoped he might have a chance to see it, or at least, get the news of it, while it was fresh. At noon the house was empty, for I do not count myself. Half an hour later the two galleries were solidly packed, the floor still empty. Another half hour later Wolfe entered and passed to his place. Then other deputies began to stream in, among them many forms and faces grown familiar of late. By 1 o'clock the membership was present in full force. A band of socialists stood grouped against the ministerial desks, in the shadow of the presidential tribune. It was observable that these official strongholds were now protected against rushes by bolted gates, and that these were in ward of servants wearing the house's livery. Also the removable desk boards had been taken away, and nothing left for disorderly members to slat with. There was a pervading, anxious hush, at least, what stood very well for a hush in that house. It was believed by many that the opposition was cowed, and that there would be no more obstruction, no more noise. That was an error. Presently the president entered by the distant door to the right, followed by Vice President Fuchs, and the two took their way down past the Polish benches toward the tribune. Instantly the customary storm of noises burst out, and rose higher and higher, and wilder, and really seemed to surpass anything that had gone before it in that place. The president took his seat and begged for order, but no one could hear him. His lips moved, one could see that. He bowed his body forward appealingly, and spread his great hand eloquently over his breast, one could see that, but as concerned his uttered words, he probably could not hear them himself. Below him was that crowd of 24 socialists glaring up at him, shaking their fists at him, roaring imprecations and insulting epithets at him. This went on for some time. Suddenly the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.